Don't you know we're talking about a revolution? Sounds
it's a Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Jake Towne and Gene DiNardo. It is Thursday, April 12th, 2012, and here are some of the headlines we're following today. U.S. stocks advanced when the Fed spoke out in a variety of different ways, saying, oh, no, no, the accommodation isn't over, but is it? Jake will be talking about what another Fed governor had to say. Italy's borrowing costs jumped, then kind of fall back after some uncertainty in Spain, so the euro is still in trouble. New government refinancing options coming from Freddie and Fannie regarding mortgage holders. We're going to be talking about U.S. foreclosure activity. It was down to a five-year low, but that new wave is still coming. Government attorney denies in front of a judge that the NDAA detention without trial provisions would apply to American citizens. We'll be looking at that and a whole bunch more information. But first, let's go to Jake with a bit of a controversy, shall we say, that continues to evolve from the Federal Reserve, with a particular governor speaking out yesterday about how there's no more need for easing. What are the details, Jake?
Well, it's a stream of propaganda, and the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Bank President Charles Plosser on Fox Business Channel gave a talk saying that, quote, the economy would have to deteriorate significantly before I would think about doing more easing of any kind, unquote, which includes another round of government bond purchases known as quantitative easing. And it's hard to figure out exactly what he means by deteriorating significantly, because the article goes on to note that, or the interview went on to note that last Friday the Labor Department found that employers added only 120,000 jobs last month, while the estimates of jobs lost in terms of unemployment claims was 380,000. So if you do a little bit of mathematics on that, it means that the economy shed another 250,000 jobs, another 260,000 jobs, or sorry, 260,000 jobs, which is definitely not improving things. And he goes on, and there's some quotes that he said that either makes me think that this guy's living a little bit on cloud nine, or if he's just putting out misinformation, because on the European mess, he said that I am not quite as worried about Europe as I was in the fall. I'm a little more comfortable that they are going to work through their challenges, but there are still risks out there, such as how deep their recession might be, unquote. And I find that a little bit hard to believe, because, you know, with the Greece defaults, I'm not sure there's really any economists out there worth their salt that would say that the condition of Europe has not deteriorated since last year. So he also did go on to say that he believes that the Federal Reserve should provide more information in terms of, you know, how it would react if the unemployment went up or down, or if certain economic indicators went a certain way, that they would communicate their policy choices to the market kind of in advance. Not really sure where he was going with that, but because obviously the Fed is that's one of the things that they like, is being able to move the market as much as they can. Anyone that looks at a stock market chart of the S&P 500 versus the announcement of QE1, QE2, and Operation Twist last fall would see that clearly they are trying to game the market.
And clearly the market was agreeing with you, with your evaluation, because yesterday, immediately after his result, his remarks, the market tanked. And today, in fact, it tanked so badly that the other Fed governors started to get into the act, talking about, oh, no, we're not done with accommodation yet. And, of course, the markets responded immediately.
Right. Well, the key language is, you know, unless things get worse. And, you know, what the Fed wants to do is they want to keep I do think that they want to kind of have this whole thing heal itself over without poking at the economy anymore, but they're kind of between a rock and a hard place, because certainly they want to keep the equity markets from not crashing. They want to keep the U.S. Treasury market from not crashing, which they had some trouble just a couple weeks ago that we were talking about on the show. And they also want to keep commodity prices low, mainly, you know, commodities such as oil, so that people can go out there and spend and not, you know, have a consumption tax removed from the rest of their consumption in the form of exporting dollars to the Middle East and other oil exporters. And that's not really going so well. Oil is still persisting over $100 a barrel on the West Texas Intermediate, even though, and, you know, obviously there's still a lot of tension surrounding Iran, which is a key player in that. But so far the Fed's kind of getting what they want, and they're saying that they're not going to do anything, but they have to leave out the, you know, the carrots, because I think they probably sense that this could come apart at any time as well.
And when they say they're not going to do anything, I mean, do they really mean that? I mean, they periodically buy bonds as just kind of a routine thing, don't they, or is that not true?
It is true, but you know, the whole thing with the Operation Twist was to kind of work, keep the interest rates down across the whole economy by pressing down on the interest rates on the longer term bonds. By purchasing those in lieu of the short-term bonds. So, yeah, what the Fed is doing, again, it's saying that the economic conditions have to worsen, meaning that they're going, you know, which, you know, in Fed speak means, you know, things are going good now, which I would tend to argue with. You know, the labor report losing a quarter million jobs certainly does not qualify as recovery of any sort. So you have the Fed kind of saying, oh, you know, everything's going okay with the economy, and, you know, we're going to stand back, you know, and only if things get worse are we going to step in. And, you know, the Fed tries to be, you know, claims to be independent politically, but it's also obviously an election year, and really the Republican challenger doesn't have a chance if there's not some more economic unrest here.
And we should also remember, too, that the Fed basically is the driver of the monetary system, and the entire monetary system is based totally on confidence, and that confidence is on very, very shaky ground, as we saw both yesterday with Plossett's comments leading to the market declining, and then today with comments by the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, plus the vice chairman of the Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen, both coming out in favor of the idea that there might be more accommodations, as Yellen referred to it, and that drove the market back up. So clearly, it's all a confidence thing. And I think we would all do well to remember that confidence is the long version of con, as in a con game. We are involved in a con game. It is literally a con game. And some people might think that's rather harsh, but hey, it's not my idea that the entire monetary system is based on confidence. That's the people who created it, who came up with that one.
Yeah, you shouldn't need to have to insert this outside confidence. People should have it inherently. The other question would be, does the Fed secretly, or not so secretly, but do they actually fear inflation? I mean, it could be that.
They want inflation.
Yeah, they're trying very hard for inflation.
Exactly, but they don't want massive inflation or intense inflation, and perhaps they think, you know, that in the back of their minds or in the back of the boardroom doors, that's a very good possibility if they keep pumping money.
Right. Well, they want to keep pumping money to keep the banks afloat, and I do think that the Fed wants inflation. You know, I mean, that's no secret. They state that, you know, a healthy, quote unquote, healthy level of inflation, which is really devaluing everybody's wealth, is 2%, is the figure widely given by people like Bernanke. But they're doing that because they also need to kind of rip away at the purchasing power of the debt that the U.S. government owns, because, you know, we always have to remember, you know, the Fed is in cahoots with the banks, but they're also in cahoots with the government in order to keep funding, you know, the military spending and what have you. So, you know, and it's you know, something's kind of going on, because I think the Federal Reserve, you know, they have these 12 regional governors, they call them, even though, you know, they're not elected by anybody, but they still get the honorific title of governor. They are regularly being sent out now to manage, like Walt was alluding to, like the psyche of the American people, and to lull people into kind of confidence that, you know, these bankers, these international bankers are on the case, everything's going to work out okay. And I think that one of the main things that they are trying to avoid, I think a hyperinflation is really a disaster in the long term. Like the banking system would be destroyed. You'd quite possibly have the rise of a new monetary system, but well before that happens, you'd have a heck of a lot of chaos, which would mean the loss of power for these folks, and would also mean a loss of funding for the federal government. So I think that that's a end game that they are definitely trying to avoid. But you know, and you have to ask yourself, how can that end game possibly come apart? Come into being? And it's going to have to be something psychological that does it. And that's why they pay so much attention to all these mind games, as it were.
Yeah, I think you're right there, and especially since the economic collapse, they've been intensifying the mind games. But it's interesting just how many people buy into the fact that they believe inflation is just a fact of life and a necessary thing and actually a good thing, and it just amazes me. I mean, the population just accepts it, and it's frustrating, really.
Well, we talked about this last week. Like, the population accepts it because I think we all see that the cost of living going up, whether it's the cost of a gallon of gas or the rent or food. But most of this inflation is ending up getting the American people don't really bear the full brunt of it. We get some of the impact. But since we have the reserve currency, it's been other countries, particularly China, that kind of have to bite the bullet on inflation. And, it would be a lot less concerning if there wasn't a way for the tables to kind of be turned on the American people. And there certainly is. And there's, there's nothing in the news like over the past several days. But I would say over the past several years, there's been more and more talk of moving away from the U.S. dollar currency, moving to a basket of currencies, or just to use a regional currency, whether it's the Chinese yuan or the yen, and between Russia and what have you. So I think that overall move away from the dollar is continuing on, and that's certainly something that the Fed would have to be concerned about in the long run.
We should also note too that Plaza's comments yesterday came at the exact same time that Italy's borrowing costs and Spain's borrowing costs were shooting upward. And what did he say? He said he's not terribly concerned about Europe. Well, one thing that we have learned, and of course we've been covering the Fed now since this show started was a little over 2 years ago now. One thing we have learned and repeated on numerous occasions, when the Fed tells you that something is not going on, you can be darn sure it's going on, because that's part of the whole misdirection thing. The fact is that Italy, their borrowing costs yesterday. Now, Italy, remember, is supposedly, if you listen to the news media, if you listen to what, the so-called authority figures and experts are telling us, Italy's problems are behind them, right? Their problems have been solved. Their economy is going to be healthy. They're going to make their comeback. They've got their austerity budget in place and so forth. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, their borrowing costs increase in one day from 1.4% to 2.84%. That had to send shockwaves through the banking system, including the central bank. So, of course, somebody was coming out to say, oh, no, Europe is not a problem at all. And, of course, that led to the market tanking, which meant that the Fed had to come back out again today and say, oh, well, we're not going to back off on our accommodation. There could be more stuff going on. Interest rates are going to stay low till 2014. So the market comes right back up again. All it was designed to do, I think, was to save everybody's confidence in the financial circles regarding the euro, regarding the European system. Because as soon as the Fed made those comments, what happened? Italy's borrowing came right back under control again. Well, not under control. It came back down a little bit compared to where it had risen to, but not nearly down to the 1.4% level it was at before. And there's a lot of concern. within the financial circles that, first of all, Spain, they also were going up, and they're still having problems. In fact, there is a lot of discussion that right now it's around 6%. If it gets up to 7%, that could be the point of no return for Spain. And then you start getting that domino effect that everybody's been talking about. But there's also concern about Italy, because if Italy starts getting up about 2 or 3 more points, they're going to be in the same kind of range, too. So I really do think this was an orchestrated set of events, with Plasser speaking yesterday, and then Yellen, and then the New York Federal Reserve Bank president speaking today. I think it was all designed to stabilize the market that was trying to tank the bonds.
Certainly a possibility.
Meanwhile, here in the United States, there are new financing options, as if we really need them, for Freddie and Fannie mortgage holders. And, Gene, you have the details about that.
Yeah, this has been in the works for a while, and months, actually. I think we talked about it a few months ago. They had brought it up, but the new version of the Home Affordable Refinance Program is now available to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac borrowers who want to refinance but who are owe more in their mortgages or are underwater. It's called HARP 2, and it's billed as an improvement over the 3-year-old original that just about everybody acknowledged didn't help many people because it put the limits on the loan-to-value ratio, the amount of mortgage as a percentage of the appraised value of a property, which pretty much eliminated all the people that actually needed the loan because they were underwater. So if the balance of the mortgage exceeded the appraised value, then the borrower couldn't refinance, and that's been dropped on this HARP 2. But that doesn't mean that all the lenders have agreed to drop the requirement. As with all these programs, the months since HARP 2 was announced have been spent trying to get lenders on board, which is no easy task. As we've also spoke about this, the Fannie and Freddie loans are pooled or have been pooled and are continually pooled as mortgage-backed securities, and that means they're owned by many investors, sometimes hundreds or more, and all the investors need to agree before borrowers can apply for reduced monthly payments at today's low fixed rates. Of course, they don't mention in this is that it makes it sound like these guys actually have control over this, but there are appointed, I forget what the term is, but there's an actually appointed person who makes a decision for all the investors. He's not appointed by the investors either. About 4 million Fannie and Freddie Mac borrowers nationwide owe more than mortgages than their homes are worth. Underwater loans also might be eligible to refinance under provisions of the recent national mortgage settlement, which applies to loans neither owned by Freddie or Fannie nor insured by the FHA, which has its own streamlined financing under a program announced in January. They're still working out details of that settlement, and eligible borrowers will be notified at some point by the five participating lenders, which are Wells Fargo, B of A, J.P. Morgan, and Ally Financial and Citibank, the same people we continually hear about. To be eligible for HARP, the homeowners must be current on their mortgage with no late payments in the past 6 months and only one in the past 12. They also need to show that they can afford the new payment. They must have closed on their current mortgage on or before May 31st, 2009, and cannot have refinanced through HARP before. In addition, mortgages must fall under current conforming loan limits. Let's see. It goes on to say that another thing they're trying to do is get the borrowers from their existing 30-year loans into their lower, like a 15 or 25-year loan. They're also trying to get rid of the interest-only mortgages. They're trying to get rid of the adjustable-rate mortgages. They had a term for this. Here's what the bankers called movement to a more stable product. Balloon mortgages and convertible adjustable-rate mortgages are eligible for HARP 2 if the conditional right to refinance the balloon or convert the ARM was exercised by the borrower and redelivered to Fannie Mae before that same date. No, actually June 1st, 2009, which is one day later than the other date. So the interesting thing about all this, and they continually do this with these programs, it sounds great, but I would almost bet the farm on the fact that the difference, this is actually like, let's say it has a house out at $300,000 and that person comes in and wants to lower the loan amount to $200,000. Well, that's a third of the value the bank would lose. I would almost bet the farm that the difference is coming from the federal government. But I'm not sure of that. Maybe you guys know. I don't know.
Well, probably also depends on how much they're making an interest, too, because that actually is more important to them from an accounting point of view.
That's true.
How much earning they're making, or interest they're collecting. Rather, they know they're going to have to take a haircut on some of these things, but if they continue to get the interest, then, you know, that makes it okay, right?
Well, maybe that's, as opposed to not getting anything at all. It seems like the interest rates, you know, for many of these loans would be lower at this point than they were since they've been falling, but that's possible. Maybe that's why they mentioned, you know, it was so hard to get these guys on board, you know, if they are going to possibly take a loss or a haircut, as they say. So it's hard to say. But a lot of these programs, you know, they get back to how much the government will kick in, and then the big guys go along.
You know, this reminds me of an article that I saw, and I can't find it here quickly, so I can't direct you to where I saw it, but I remember reading it a couple days ago. And, of course, as we all know, it was subprime mortgages that kicked off the whole financial crisis. And in theory, those are all gone because those have all been foreclosed or, you know, have gone bad or been, you know, eaten up by somebody else or appeared on the Fed balance sheet. But this particular article was fascinating because the headline was something to the effect of subprime loans are back. It didn't say mortgages. It said loans. And that this is a good thing. The reason they were saying this is going to really rock your boat. They were saying that subprime borrowers are now being loaned to at a very fast pace, not for mortgages, but for car loans and credit cards and other forms of consumer debt. So this was considered a good thing because, of course, when people who can't afford to borrow based on consumer debt, that drives the economy along, right? I mean, I read this thing. I said, are these people mental? I don't understand.
It leads to what they consider growth in the economy, too.
That's right, yeah. Well, we've talked about this before. If you show an overall increase in GDP driven by basically increasing the money supply driven by large amounts of lending, well, then you have a healthy economy, right?
That's right.
God almighty.
The interesting thing is, okay, now a lot of these things are backed by the government, different loans and all that. But even if they take a loss, is that necessarily, I don't see it, it's not really reflected in the GDP. In other words, it can be reflected when a person goes beyond their means and buys too much. Of course, that goes into the product, the gross domestic product. But, you know, but when they can't pay, you don't really see that.
It's funny how the accounting works, isn't it?
It is funny. Funny how they account it.
Absolutely. Well, meanwhile, the world of politics is basically cooking along quietly, not getting a whole lot of attention, but there have been a few developments, including the fact that one of the leading contenders for the Republican nomination dropped out. Jake, what are the details?
That's right. Rick Santorum has ended his presidential bid on Tuesday. Initially claiming about the illness of his 3-year-old daughter, Bella, who had a rare genetic disorder, saying that he wants to spend more time with her as a parent. He also today came out and stated that it came down to reality. He did not have any cash left. And after losing Wisconsin's April 3rd primary to Romney by 7 points, he really was not receiving any funds at all. The next main primary, the Missouri, the Republican caucus or what have you, is April 17th. But really the next on the 2012 primary schedule, April is a very quiet month. April 24th, however, we'll see the primaries of Pennsylvania and New York, along with a few minor New England states such as Connecticut, Delaware, and Rhode Island. New York and Pennsylvania between them have about 167 delegates at stake for the Tampa convention. And it's, back to Santorum for a bit, it's kind of odd his decision to kind of pull out at this point. You kind of think that with Pennsylvania coming up and the neighboring state of New York, he might have felt like, he should at least stay in until the end of Pennsylvania. But I can tell you what a lot of people forget is Rick Santorum lost his Senate race here, the last race that he ran in Pennsylvania. And he's really, I live in Pennsylvania, he's really not all that well-liked across the state, either by Democrats or Republicans both. So it's also possible that he just saw that he was going to get beat in Pennsylvania and decided to pull out since his chances of getting the required number of delegates are pretty low. However, there is still about 900 delegates left. The major states coming up are California and Texas, which normally don't play much of a factor in the race. But with Mitt Romney currently having about 666 delegates, which is what the mainstream media puts out there, he probably really has, in terms of bound delegates, about two-thirds of that. So he'd have to get pretty much all the remaining ones. So it does kind of seem, with Santorum out of the race, it becomes more likely that Romney will be the eventual contender. However, it really doesn't look like it's going to get solved in the first round of voting from where I sit. And you also have to remember that Santorum's delegates, he racked up close to, I think it was about 300 or so. Those delegates, about 100 of them are unbound, so they'll really be able to vote for whoever they wish. But the other delegates are bound, and they will have to vote for him in the first round in the Tampa convention, at least 188. He could decide to release them, but if he releases them, then they can vote for anybody, so they'd just be unbound delegates. So all the speculation is out there. And even if Santorum does, in fact, endorse Mitt Romney, that doesn't mean he can gift all of his delegates. They'll be able to, if he does release the delegates, they'll become free agents, really, and it'll be up to their minds who they vote for. So I would say, you know, with him out of the race, it does become a bit more probable for Romney to become the eventual nominee. But I think it also gives the other two candidates left in the race, Newt Gingrich and Ron Paul, a chance to rack up, if they can get some wins out of the rest of the schedule or impressive vote totals, and just get as many delegates as possible and make it more difficult. It could go into the second round, and, of course, when that happens, they're all unbound. So stranger things have happened, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, where the folks that were supporting Santorum, which primarily came from the evangelical wing of the Republican Party, then decide to go.
Well, it depends on whose count you look at. But the one thing I do have to say is everybody's counts that I've seen suggest that Romney has more votes than the other candidates combined. So that means that not only do either Gingrich or Paul or both have to start winning some primaries, but they have to start winning all the remaining primaries. Otherwise, you know, Romney will just kind of rot out, so to speak. I don't see anything that convinces me that we're really bound for a second round. I mean, if we were bound for a second round, that would be a really fascinating convention, but I don't know, maybe I'm just reading the cards differently from you, but to me it looks like it's going to be, you know, Romney taking it, even if he just squeaks through.
All right. I think, you know, I think that the chances of getting by the first vote is probably low. All I'm doing is trying to point out that the chances of Mitt Romney getting over 1,100 or 1,144 bound delegates is that's probably not going to happen. So,
okay.
Yeah,
it stands to reason that Santorum would probably throw his support the direction of Romney just because he probably will be thinking of the future and his standing with all the powerful guys in the party and stuff. But you know, he could withhold it. It's hard to say.
The unbound guys, too, I kind of suspect that they'll go for Romney just because there's such a large amount of pressure to end the whole thing. There's so much press talking about it and so forth, about how it's been dragging on and on and on. And I imagine that most of those unbound delegates are going to be party faithful at the upper echelon, so they're going to do everything they can to support that, even if it means holding their nose and voting for Romney. Well, we need to take a break, and then after the break, we're going to talk a little bit more about what's going on with the campaign. Plus, we'll be looking at some of the things that are happening overseas, various wars and so forth going on, and we'll take a very interesting look at what's going on with the NDAA and a rather surprising confrontation that took place between a government attorney and a judge, so you want to stay tuned for that. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network. We will be right back. Yep, we're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown with Walt, Jake, and Gene. And getting back to the political picture, Gene's got some details about what's happening with one of those other candidates, Newt Gingrich, having his own troubles with his campaign, isn't he?
Well, yeah, the Newt put together, or his folks put together a group a few years ago. Let me read from the article here. He started a healthcare think tank. It was created by Newt Gingrich, and apparently it's going out of business. The Gingrich Group, also known as the Center for Health Transformation, filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy in federal court in Atlanta on Wednesday. The bankruptcy filing marks an abrupt turn for a group that raised millions of dollars just a few years ago to support and promote Gingrich's healthcare ideas. The center's filings indicated as liabilities between $1 million and $10 million and between 50 and 99 creditors. The group had assets of only up to $100,000. Obviously, that doesn't work. But they had some great ideas to how to fix health care, but they couldn't quite keep their own finances together. Newt cut ties to the Center for Health Transformation and the Gingrich Group in May 2011 as he prepared his presidential run. That was from his attorney, Stephen Positino. Gingrich's group created the for-profit center in 2003 to focus on health-related initiatives, Medicare changes, and President Obama's health care overhaul. At its peak, it attracted a range of health care providers and others who shelled out big bucks to become members, the attorney said. It's kind of an interesting little side note, I guess, on the campaign. But speaking of health care, it's funny because I got an email. We at this show here, we get quite a few emails from industry groups, and it was a pharmaceutical industry group. That was it. I don't know if I brought this up, but they're expressing how they feared that the health care bill would be turned down in Supreme Court and how they thought their stocks would drop like crazy if that happened. Did I bring that up last week? I don't know. But I just thought that was interesting. This whole health care thing is so tied to the government.
They're frustrated because, I mean, they're a lobbyist organization, right?
Right, that's what it was.
But unfortunately, right? You can't get into the lobby of the Supreme Court. So they're frustrated.
Yeah. You can't lobby the Supreme Court. We can change that. Maybe the Supreme Court can have a decision that changes that.
I wouldn't be surprised. But,
I wouldn't be surprised.
Then again, I wouldn't be surprised by almost anything that happens at the federal level. Meanwhile, there's been other interesting developments going on in a variety of different areas. Let's go first to something that I shared with Jake. Jake, did you have a chance to read that article I passed you about the judge and the government attorney going head-to-head over the NDAA?
Yeah, it's fascinating.
It's a very fascinating article. This is something that appears on a blog. It's a blog by Naomi Wolf. And in her blog entry, she basically took notes from a recent NDAA hearing that appeared before Judge Forrest. Now, it's a rather long transcript that she put together, and I have to give her credit for all the detail that went into her transcript. But you can find it at naomiwolf.org, and once you find it, if you scroll down about 20%, you'll come to a section of the proceedings where Judge Forrest is going, like I said, head-to-head with the government attorney, and he's very specifically trying to get the attorney to specify what the limitations of the NDAA are regarding references to trials for U.S. citizens, but not of what kind of trials they would be. He says, I want to clarify that U.S. citizens wouldn't be detained without trial. It is unclear what kind of trial they get. Tell me, he says to the government lawyers, what it means to give substantial support. I just want one example. And the government lawyer replies, I'm not in a position to give an example. Judge Forrest says, well, just give me one. And the lawyer says, well, I can only give you context. Context? Really? I mean, this is not a difficult question, guys.
Apparently it was for him.
So it goes on, and just reading a little bit further down, again in the same section, Judge Forrest was pushing to determine the boundaries of the NDAA law. Obama's lawyer said it would take a case of someone being detained under the NDAA to find the parameters of the law. Think about that one. Judge Forrest did think about it, and he said, is it really adequate to say you have to go to a D.C. court in detention to figure this out? Are you going to have to wait for courts other than this one to decide who, quote, associated forces, unquote, are? Is this the only way we can figure this out? And she asked the government lawyer for an example of a boundary around associated forces. Judge Forrest, I don't want precision. I want a boundary. Obama's lawyer says, I don't have specifics. Judge Forrest says, associated forces, what are they? And there's this empty pause. And then Judge Forrest says, well, if you can't stand here and say Section 1021 won't touch, say, Ms. O'Brien, unless if you did, we would be done. And if you can't do that, well, you leave us in a tough spot here. No kidding. In fact, yeah. It leaves the entire country in a tough spot. And this is exactly what all the criticism about the NDAA was about, specifically Section 1021, which, Jake, you have done a tremendous amount of reporting on in past shows.
Yeah, no, this bill really is exactly, the folks that are going against the federal government in this session was Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Christopher Hedges, the co-founder of Occupy London, so a British national, and journalists Alex O'Brien, Daniel Ellsberg, Noam Chomsky, a very famous anti-war writer, and also Brigitta Jónsdóttir, who is an Icelandic parliamentarian, and a few others are trying to join it, especially Naomi Wolf. And they're just going in there to, and in a lawsuit, they're trying to say that, this is harming their right to free speech, which is kind of difficult because there is no physical harm that's happened to any of these people in the party so far. Although, one of the journalists detailed how private security firms are following her. And,
That wouldn't reduce your free speech at all, would it?
No. You're just being tailed by bugs, no issue. But yeah,
you have plenty of free speech. Just mum's the word.
It strikes a definite, and like Occupy London, for instance, was listed by the City of London as a terrorist organization. So they're claiming that possibly the U.S. Armed Forces are going to come in there and abduct them because they are a terrorist organization. And you have to, just pragmatically looking at this, you have to be like, well, you know what, if the government's going to call them a terrorist organization, there is some type of risk because what are they doing right now? They're bombing, people that they call terrorists in Yemen. We've started 10-year long wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, all in the pursuit of these terrorist groups. So certainly government, there's pretty easy to say that government wants to kill, maim, or imprison terrorists. So having groups called that is certainly important. And I think that it's exactly, it was interesting how the federal lawyer who, wants to preserve as much power to the executive branch, Barack Obama, and the federal government as possible, really tried to leave it pretty much as if, oh, we can do anything. And all of the responses, that's pretty much what that lawyer was going for.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's really clear when you read this thing. I mean, at one point they were talking about a hypothetical book. It was a hypothetical topic. And this hypothetical book has only one sentence in it that's of any issue. And the sentence is, I support the political goals of the Taliban. So in other words, somebody publishes a hypothetical book that says, I support the political goals of the Taliban. Now, the judge said, based on that, she asked the government lawyers if such a book could be read as providing material support for associated forces under the NDAA. And the answer came back, well, they couldn't rule it out.
Yeah, so, they don't know.
So the judge said, well, you are unable to say that such a book consisting of political speech could not be captured under Section 1021. And the lawyer said, well, we can't say that. And the judge says, are you telling me that no U.S. citizen can be detained under 1021? Well, that's not a reasonable fear. Well, say it's reasonable to fear you will be unlucky and face detention or trial. What does directly supported mean? And the lawyer says, well, we have not said anything about that. Well, what do you think it means? Give me an example that distinguishes between direct and indirect support. Give me a single example. Well, we have not come to a position on that either. So assume you are a U.S. citizen trying not to run afoul of this law. What does this phrase mean to you? And the Obama's lawyer says, I couldn't offer any specific language. I don't have a specific example. oh, my goodness.
It's not even open.
I mean, forgive the phrase, the balls of standing in front of a U.S. judge and basically doing a two-step, trying to avoid facing the fact that this law that you're supporting violates every single facet of the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah, and back to the trial, I found that to be, because when I read the NDAA, I also was like, well, does this mean trial by jury or military trial? Because I guess it's less offensive if it's a trial by jury, and that maybe you're going to be able to get out. But you know, the federal prosecutor was very vehement in that. You know, they what the federal government probably wants to do is decide, you know, if they're going to Guantanamo American citizens or not. So yeah, it's
and there's a thought for you.
Well, you know, it's interesting because this classification that they do has been used for years. I mean, they did it during the Vietnam War, and they would classify groups, you know, not as terrorists is the new classification. You know, it started with McCarthyism and communism and all that and moved into the anti-war groups. But basically, they once they classify them, then it gives them the power to do things that they are not allowed to do to normal citizens and shouldn't be really be allowed to do to anybody. And you know, it's the terrorism classification is their more modern excuse. You know, anybody, you know, putting the London occupiers as terrorists? I mean, that's ridiculous. It's so far removed from the reality of the situation. It's crazy.
And it blurs the line. I mean,
blurs the line.
You,
right.
you can claim that they're targeting particular groups, but the way these things are worded, there is no such thing as an ordinary U.S. citizen anymore because you're all targeted under it.
You're right. And you know what's interesting is how it's this whole line of thought is creeping into the private sector, I guess you would say. With the, the Florida Marlin ball player, the baseball guy, pro guy, I forget his last name, but, you know, his mention that he was from Cuba, he mentioned he liked Fidel, which is a pretty innocuous statement.
Oh, Ozzie Guillen, the manager, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, he liked Fidel doesn't necessarily mean, you know, he likes this about Fidel. You know, maybe he just likes the cigars he smokes. He says this, and it's a huge uproar, you know.
Suspended for 5 games. That's how huge it was.
Yeah, what does that have to do with playing baseball? I just don't get it, you know. And I think it's becoming pervasive in the way we think about things. You know, it's either black, everything's black or white.
Well, obviously it's because it's Miami, and Miami has a gigantic Cuban population, and that Cuban population is vehemently anti-Castro, so that's the reason.
Yeah,
but is it a justifiable reason?
And I guess it does get back to dollars and cents if you think about it, because what they're thinking is, well, if we don't do anything to this guy, maybe some of those people or a lot of those people won't buy tickets next year.
Exactly, that's precisely what they're thinking.
Yeah, but it is kind of along the same lines, I think.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for that. That's really true. Well, partisanship has played a role in a lot of this kind of thing, and it continues to play roles in many, many other ways, as it will for decades on end. One of the ways that it has played a role recently, though, has been in the world of infrastructure, which doesn't get a whole lot of attention, does it? But still, it has played a significant role, and it has led to some rather unusual myths to be raised, Gene.
Yeah, I think the article it basically talks about how they're having a really hard time getting any the highway projects done, and there's kind of there's a conservative movement to cut the spending, and I think it really, you know, especially the neoconservatives are very, they have very little concern with cutting spending, but they do like to cut programs they don't like. And the main reason they don't like the highway programs, I think, is because the union benefits so greatly. I think the Teamsters, isn't it? I mean, they've made so much money over the years. But, you know, it kind of brings into context, people have this misconception that our roads are paid for by the gas tax, and it's not really true. It has actually never been true. I think it was originally initiated under the highway plan of the 60s or the 50s and 60s when they started building the highways. And they proposed that the gas tax would pay for the highways, but it never did. And the estimates are that the gas tax probably paid for maybe half of that project. But they also what's not understood is that roads are actually taken care of and built on three levels, federal, state, and county. And the gas tax that we most commonly talk about, it applies to the federal level, which is actually pays for up to somewhere between 85% and 90% of the spending on roads, the federal spending. But what is kind of deceiving in that whole thing is if you look inside of it, 35% of the fund is just loans, so it hasn't been paid for at all. It has to be paid for in the future. At the state level, each state does it differently. Most states average about 40% from the gas tax, and the rest they get from income taxes or whatever, general fund. And the county level is even worse. Most counties don't have a gas tax at all, although some have instituted some, and the money mostly comes from property taxes usually. So, you know, this great misconception that we're paying for the roads through the people who use them is just that. It's a misconception. But I'll read a little bit from the article. The Senate and House of Representatives are engaged in a kind of ugly impasse. It's grown common in recent years. They've engaged in what Representative Earl Blumauer called the infrastructure chicken. Historically, Congress authorized road and infrastructure programs for several years at a time. Transportation planners could look ahead, set priorities, and line up contractors. The last such comprehensive measure passed with strong bipartisan support in 2005, and it expired in 2009. Since then, as bitter partisanship has become the legislative norm, Congress has been unable to craft a long-term plan. Short-term extensions have become routine. Projects most affected could include major highway reconstruction, new bridges, and other really big projects that cost multiple millions. Goes on to say, equal worrisome to transportation planners is how partisan confrontation is affecting an area of public policy that traditionally has been more about how to divide the riches. It's an interesting way to put it. He goes on to say, or actually this is a quote from Tom Trotter, AFL-CIO legislative representative. Bridges and highways are not necessarily Republican or Democrat. Everybody needs them, especially the unions. Money for the Highway Trust Fund is supposed to come largely from an 18.4 cent a gallon federal gasoline tax. That was last increased in 1993. The 2005 transportation law made big commitments, and the economic slump that began in 2007 hurt revenue collection, and the fund is expected to exhaust its ability to pay its commitments sometime next year. So they're making this up. The money is made up from the general fund, it goes on to say. House Republicans leaders proposed a five-year, $260 billion transportation plan that would include revenues from fees from new domestic oil drilling, though more funding would still be needed. So they're having problems basically because I think that people don't want to raise the gas tax, especially now with gas so high, yet they still want to use the roads, and it's kind of a whole interesting concept. I don't think I'm kind of in the realm of thought that I don't see why the government has to do that at all. It's crazy, but
it's certainly a question that doesn't get a lot of attention because it's such a small piece of the overall budget. But it's a valid point. The fact is that the way that they handle the budget, everything's just in this gigantic pot. It doesn't really make any difference whether there's a gas task. I mean, they're basically just allocating funds any way they want to.
Right.
And meanwhile, while you're reporting that, Jake, as his want, is, as usual, doing a little research on the topic we were just talking about and found yet another example of how the U.S. Justice Department continues to try to overreach, and it involves, among other things, WikiLeaks. What are the details on that, Jake?
Right. Well, one of the people in the lawsuit that we were just talking about who's trying to get standing against the federal government is an Icelandic member of parliament, Brigitte Jónsdóttir, which I'm probably saying incorrectly. But she was a part of WikiLeaks and worked on the collateral murder video, which later resulted in the arrest of Bradley Manning, who is under a military trial currently. And Brigida was an active volunteer. It sounds like she actually did the video editing for this. And when it was released back in 2010, she did talk about it coming out. And she carried on a Twitter account this entire time. And in January of last year, she was notified by Twitter that Twitter had been served by the U.S. Department of Justice to demanding information consisting of all of her tweets and everything since November 1st, 2009, which included, so this is what the DOJ was trying to get from Twitter in regards to her, all of her mailing addresses and billing information, all connection records and session times, all of her IP addresses used to access Twitter, all of her known email accounts, as well as the means and source of payment. Apparently there was something involving financial here, including her banking records and credit cards. And as a result, she has stated that she's fears to be thrown into a cell and detained and questioned if she comes to the United States, which she has been wanting to do. And there was an exchange about this in the Naomi Wolf transcript where you flat out asked, you know, does she need to worry about being apprehended? And the lawyer says, well, you know, the embassy said that she won't be subject to detention and interrogation. And to which their defense replied that they refused to put them in writing, so they might still do it. And it just resulted in another kind of roundabout. The lawyer for the Obama administration said, they did say that from what we know, the member would not be subject to 1021, meaning that they're not going to yank her off the streets and throw her into a cell. But then they go on to quantify it and say, well, you know, that's just what I know now. Maybe she's done something else or, some other fact's going to come up.
Which is basically legalese for, I don't want to have to answer the question now, so I'll make it sound like we wouldn't do anything, when in fact we probably would.
It's funny how these policies that Bush so aptly generated just continued right through the Obama administration.
Yeah, I thought Obama was supposed to be about change.
Change, yeah.
Well, no, that's one of the symptoms of a totalitarian society. It makes you look back at the guy who came before with some degree of, you know, almost nostalgia. Like, oh, you know, that crazy Bush guy, you know, he could barely put, full sentences together. But he eroded very successfully American civil liberties. And Barack Obama, you know, for all of his promises that, hey, you know, we're going to close Gitmo, we're going to stop torture, just those two very basic, very, you know, humanitarian, call whatever you will, just those two very basic things, he did not deliver on it. And with things like this NDAA Act, which he signed into law, it just further shows that Obama is not interested in preserving anyone's civil liberties when it comes right down to it.
Meet the new boss, same as the old boss.
Yep.
That's about the size of it. Well, we're running out of time, but I just want to remind everybody, you can always find out what's upcoming on the show by visiting our website, www.freedomnewshour.com. You can also check out our archives there on the site, as well as the archives on the main site for the network, prn.fm. So be sure to check that out. Just one last thought I want to pass your way, guys. The show that precedes us, the host said at the end of their show, the elevator can only go up from here. I think we've very effectively shown that that's not necessarily true. The elevator can go down from here. Things can get much worse. And if that doesn't make you depressed, well, that's a good thing, because at least you have a positive attitude. Guys, it's been a pleasure as usual.
All right, everybody, hey. Take care.
We'll see you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.